Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A proposed House bill would bar the death penalty in cases where the convicted can prove he or she suffered from serious mental illness while committing the murder. Defendants would be barred from the death penalty if they are diagnosed with schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, or delusional disorder. Evelyn Lundberg Stratton is a former Ohio Supreme Court Justice and current project director for the Ohio Stepping Up Initiative that aims to reduce the number of people with mental illness in our jails and prisons. She spent the last 5 years working on the bill. She joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's exciting to be back with you again.
State Representative David Leland represents the 22nd District. That includes North Columbus and Clintonville. He's a Democrat and ranking minority member on the Ohio House, the House Criminal Justice Committee, and is a co-sponsor of the bill. Representative Leland joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. It's great to be here.
The bill passed the House earlier this month. One of the issues that makes it controversial is that it also provides a way for a person sentenced to death for aggravated murder to appeal the sentence retroactively. And prosecutors are saying that everyone on death row will appeal. What do you make of that, Representative Leland?
Well, we heard a lot of testimony about that, and I think that they've overstated the amount of appeals that they're going to have. But, you know, the reality is that they're only going to be appealing the part as to the mental illness part. They're not going to be retrying the entire case. And I think that if you have a person on death row that suffers from a serious mental illness or did so at the time they committed the crime, then they should be able to avail themselves of this particular exemption. I want to make one thing perfectly clear, though. We added a provision onto this bill that stated very clearly that if a person was to receive the SMI exemption, the serious mental illness exemption under the bill, that the sentence, and this would certainly apply to people that are already on death row, the sentence would only be then life imprisonment without parole. So nobody is going to be put back on the streets here. They may reduce the death penalty to life imprisonment without parole, but no one is going to be walking the streets of Ohio because of this particular bill. So I think it's a good balance between making sure that we're protecting the rights and safety of the people of Ohio, but also making sure that we're not committing a death penalty to people who suffer a serious mental illness.
We know that the number of people nationally in prisons, one in five are mentally ill. What do we know about the numbers when it comes to people on death row, Representative Leland?
We heard a lot of different testimony. I think that's what probably the hearings will be about as far as the number of people. And you have an expert on this phone call. I mean, she if anybody was responsible for the fact that we had such an overwhelming vote, this passed out of our committee by a vote of 11-1, and it passed out of the House with almost 80 votes. I think a lot of the credit goes to Justice Stratton for her very impassioned testimony that she made in front of our committee. So I think she can probably add some insight onto that, but I think that we're going to find that information out by going through these SMI hearings if the bill passes.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Representative Ohio State Representative David Leland from the 22nd District. He is co-sponsor of House Bill 136. That would ban the death penalty for people who are found to have been seriously mentally ill while committing a capital crime. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Also with us is former Ohio Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Lundberg Stratton. She's project director for the Ohio Stepping Up Initiative. And as I mentioned earlier, she's been working for 5 years on getting the likes of House Bill 136 passed. It's now pending in the Senate. Justice Stratton, what about that? I mean, we know one in five in prisons are mentally ill. What about that seriously mentally ill piece that's addressed in House Bill 136 and the number of people on death row?
Well, we have to distinguish between just having some sort of mental illness, right, or depression versus the five categories. The House took out one, but it doesn't make any sense because it's still one of the five categories. I think they've confused major depressive disorder with just regular depression.
Clinical depression, yeah.
But there was a national study done, Washington Post reported on it, and they found that 43% of the inmates executed between 2000 and 2015 had received a mental diagnosis at some point in their lives. But when we looked at Ohio statistics, Harvard University students did a study of the bill that was pending in 2016 in Ohio. And they looked at the 26 who are currently set for execution at that point. Only six, really, of the 26 had a mental illness, but only two of the 26 would have met the five categories, the serious mental illness. We've looked at the whole group of defendants on death row. There's about roughly 240. Of that, only 10 to 15 really would fit the five categories to be able to apply for a retroactive application. And again, as Representative Leland said, this is not about conviction. It does not touch conviction. Conviction is not challenged at all in this bill.
This is not get out of jail.
This is only whether you get death or not, and the House voted to default to life if you had a retroactive case. I don't have any problem with that because they got that serious diagnosis in the first place. But the parade of horribles that this is going to end the death penalty and everybody's going to apply— The defense attorneys have an ethical obligation only to bring cases that have merits. The psychiatrists are not going to fake an illness to try to end the death penalty. I'm not against the death penalty. I'm just against executing persons with mental illness. So this is not going to happen. It's not going to be everybody applying.
For people out there who have lost a loved one at the hands of somebody who may qualify for this, what is the reasoning for doing this? Why should somebody who has a serious mental illness escape the death penalty?
Well, most of the states have a category called diminished capacity as an excuse or a defense in a conviction basis. We had that years ago, and then all the death statutes were found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Everybody had to start all over, and it came out. So we no longer have diminished capacity in the conviction statute. But what happens with people like this is they have diminished capacity, so to the point that we do not believe under the standards that the Supreme Court has set for not executing persons with intellectual disabilities, not executing kids under 18. We think that same standard should fit here because they had diminished capacity because of what their mental illness did. So here's an example. You have somebody that the prosecutor says they knew right from wrong. They ran away. They admit they knew right from wrong. That's the standard for conviction in Ohio. So they convict them. But when you look into their medical history, and we had some horrific histories in the cases that I saw on the bench, they may have known right from wrong, but they did the act because they had an alien being telling them that they needed to do this to save the world. There's these delusions of grandeur that people have that control their behavior. But you knew right from wrong, so you convict him, but you can't, the mitigation doesn't work. And we can go into that again in a separate question, but there's a whole mitigation issue around that.
How does Ohio law currently juggle the issue of mental illness? At the sentencing, you're saying that just if they knew right from wrong, that's it? Or how does a judge?
Well, you get the conviction based on what the law currently is, and right from wrong is one of the standards. If they knew it, you can find them guilty, even though diminished capacity is not allowed in Ohio for conviction. So then you move to the sentencing phase.
Yeah, okay.
There's supposed to be evidence that you can present on your mental illness, but there have been some major studies of thousands of jurors after a death penalty case, and the majority of them actually turned it around backwards because the evidence was presented of mental illness, they tended to go to death more than use it as mitigation. So when the prosecutors say, well, they got mitigation, they can present mitigation, the jurors don't use it that way. The jurors tend to be, oh, I'm so afraid, I can't let him get out. You know, he's so evil, he's so violent. They tend to turn it the opposite way. So when you present evidence of a serious mental illness, it actually causes more death penalty sentences when it should be working the opposite way. So it's failed. So we can't really rely on that.
David Leland, did the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association, did they oppose the bill?
Yes, they did. And I wanted to just jump in a little bit about that study, about the mitigation piece, because we heard that in the committee, and it was very, very impressive. But it also sent another message, too. And it not only sent the message that they were using the death penalty more for people who had mental illness, the jurors were, but it also sent another message to me and the rest of the committee, and that was people were afraid that these people were going to be back out in the streets, which is why, and I talked about this earlier, but which is why we added the provision onto the bill that would, that if a person were to be exempted under the serious mental illness exemption and was convicted of aggravated murder, then they would be sentenced to life imprisonment without parole, because that way we would take care of the concerns of people of having these people back out on the streets. You know, our first responsibility is to protect the health and safety of all Ohioans, and so while we while the serious mental health or serious mental illness modification is a reasonable modification to the death penalty law, we also felt it was our obligation to protect the people of Ohio, which is why we added the life without parole onto the bill.
Why not just return diminished capacity to the law as it stood before it was found unconstitutional and then became a state's issue?
I would very much be
What's
in favor
of that.
What's
the objection to that? I mean, if you say in some states they do have diminished capacity, in Ohio they never...
It's another hill to climb. When you look at 5 years of fighting,
just for this,
we have compromised repeatedly to try to meet the prosecutor's objections. They basically finally told me, we don't care how much you take out, we're still going to object. And so if you can't even get them to agree that this very small subset should not be executed if they have mental illness, it would be an enormous hill to climb to try to get it back into statute. I personally favor it from the cases I saw. Yeah, I think it should be one of the standards in conviction, but it's another hill to climb.
And David Leland?
Well, I mean, I think that's something we could take a look at, but I think we reached a very clear bipartisan majority on this particular piece of legislation. I mean, you had people that were anti-death penalty, pro-death penalty, both of them, both groups, Democrats and Republicans, in large numbers supporting this particular measure. Let's get this one done first, and then we can take a look at what else needs to be done in Ohio.
And I appreciate Representative Leland, you giving me some of this credit, but I really want to share it with a very hardworking team of advocates, NAMI, and there's a group that's opposing the death penalty generally, and Dr. Testa and others that really, really were a very strong part of the team in making sure that the testimony was accurate and powerful. And I want to give credit to those that worked with us.
Are there laws like House Bill 136 in other states that have been enacted in other states that are this specific?
I don't.
We asked that question during the testimony, and I think the answer was no. I mean, I don't want to. There may be one, so I don't want to be categorically saying that there isn't one. But I think we heard testimony. I think it was from the public defender Tim Young. He indicated that there weren't statutes like this. States were either deciding not to do this or to repeal their death penalty. There didn't seem to be a middle ground like was what we were doing here. So I will defer to Justice Stratton on this, but I think that was what the testimony was, what we heard in the committee.
Well, when the U.S. Supreme Court found that executing persons with intellectual disabilities was unconstitutional and that became retroactive, the Supreme Court said they left it to the states to set the standards on mental illness. And when I was on the Supreme Court, if I was able to get 4 votes, I could have made the law. That's all you need to make that law. Mm-hmm. But I felt that it was a much more fluid standard. There were no clear definitions like age or mental intellectual disabilities. And I threw it to the legislature in my concurrences. I threw the challenge to the legislature. You should take up what the Supreme Court has said. You should pass this standard. And so a lot of states are looking to Ohio because we're one of the first to do it. But as Representative Leland said, a lot of states in the meantime have abolished the death penalty, so it's not even an issue there.
Okay. David Leland, were you going to say something?
Oh, no, no.
Okay. I want to thank you, Representative Leland, for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, it's always great to be here, and thank you for including me.
And thank you for your support, Representative Leland. We appreciate it.
Thank you for your hard work and dedication.
Representative Leland, he represents the district, 22nd District. It's Northern Columbus, Clintonville area. He's co-sponsor of House Bill 136, which would eliminate the death penalty as an option for in certain capital cases in which a person has been found to be seriously mentally ill when the crime was committed. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation with Justice Stratton, and we're also going to hear about crisis intervention teams on police law enforcement in law enforcement agencies, and also mental health courts and the role they play in all of this. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A proposed House bill would bar the death penalty in certain cases where the convicted can prove he or she suffered from serious mental illness while committing the murder. The proposal comes from a growing understanding about the role of mental illness in crime. This hour, we're talking about that intersection of mental health and criminal justice. Still with us is former Ohio Supreme Court Justice and current project director for the Ohio Stepping Up Initiative that aims to reduce the number of people with mental illness that are in our jails, Evelyn Lundberg-Stratton. And thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
You and I were talking off air. I wanted to touch on it briefly, the issue of people who are intellectually disabled. A law was passed some years ago that barred them from being eligible for the death penalty.
Correct.
How did that work? That got through.
Well,
what happened?
Actually, that was as a result of the U.S. Supreme Court saying
that's
you can't.
Right, yeah.
And so the law was fairly easy because you had to pass it. But there were the same claims that everybody was going to apply, and it was, you know, it was also retroactive. But we had maybe 15, maybe possibly 20 claims. And the majority of them, when you looked at the data under the new standard, they were intellectually disabled. And so everybody just then agreed to the life sentence and didn't even I can remember maybe one appeal ever on that came up to us after that law passed.
There are people who oppose this, saying everybody on death row is going to appeal their death sentence, and that it'll cost money. So in that case, everyone just agreed it was relatively undisputed when somebody was found to be intellectually disabled. And the prediction is, given the narrowness of these categories, that the same thing would happen.
Well, I wrote on or joined concurrences and or dissents in about four or five cases where, you know, you had 20 hospitalizations, you had multiple findings that they were schizophrenic or bipolar. When you look at that evidence under the new standard, there's not going to be disagreement. So they'll just automatically agree to life and it'll go on, because it's not like, you know, the person, we hardly ever saw a case where somebody killed somebody and then said all of a sudden, oh, I was mentally ill at the time. If they don't have that whole track record, you're not going to make the case. You're not going to make the case.
The Ohio General Assembly has legislated funding to smaller, or I shouldn't say smaller counties, but less populated counties, the poorer counties, really, to manage death penalty cases.
Right.
What are the economics of all of this for people who care? Are the bean counters out there?
Well, I know a lot of it came out of the Portsmouth, because it one death penalty case in a small county will just break their budget for the entire year. When you have a case where life is the only possibility, it's tried as a regular case, and you have all the regular protections of any other type of criminal case. When you have a death penalty, you have to have special jury draws, you have to have extra counsel, you have to have extra experts. There's all sorts of extra costs attendant to it. And particularly in a case with mental illness, you will have the experts on mental illness. Did they or did they not have this psychosis or this mental illness, which doubles the costs again. So when you don't have all that in that case, those that meet the standard will certainly reduce the cost for the county. And they still can get their full conviction. The prosecutors can still get life without parole. It's just you don't have the expenses of the death penalty.
How did we get to the point that one in five inmates in the country suffers from mental illness in the first place? Is it a chicken and egg issue in some cases?
Nope.
Okay.
It has its roots back in the 1950s. There were a lot of people in what we called then the insane asylums, the mental health hospitals. And many of them, granted, had very poor conditions. Many of them didn't. Many of them took very good care of their people, but many of them didn't. And there was this big social movement to take them out, close those down, put the least, you know, restrictive environment, you know, let them get it back out. There were some major problems with that. One is that it never got funded. Kennedy was a very big proponent of this. And when he was assassinated, his proposal for funding died on the vine. The counties basically did not repurpose the money from closing down those hospitals into community centers. And the other problem was one of the major symptoms of an illness is that you don't recognize you have one. You can't understand you have one. So you won't go to a community center for treatment if you're let out. And a lot of these people that were let out had no ability to function in the outside world. They had never been in the outside world. So basically, they got reinstitutionalized in jails and prisons. The Los Angeles County Jail is the largest mental health facility in the country. In Ohio, the Ohio prison is our largest mental health facility. And in almost every county, the county jail is the largest mental health facility.
Does imprisoning people cost more than treating them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things, stepping up is focused on jail. It's not focused on prison. Mm-hmm. There's a couple other projects I worked in that worked on justice reinvestment mainly that focused on prison. This focuses on jails. Because what happens is when somebody has a drug abuse issue, an addiction, they're arrested, they go to jail, they detox, they become much less of a problem. Somebody who has a mental health issue goes to jail, particularly if they're off their medications or never have been diagnosed, they get worse. So the majority of the jail's funding for overtime and crisis management and also and drugs to treat, to take care of people, all dramatically higher cost for only the, you know, 20 or 30% that have mental illness. Plus, they don't have the training or the background. And that was the root of this movement. The sheriffs went to the National Sheriff's Association, went to the National County Commissioners Association and said, we're the de facto jail hospital. We don't have any resources. Help us. So they started this project called Stepping Up, which really focuses on jails.
And what does it mean to participate in this project? What difference does it make?
Okay, so you start with the county commissioners have to sign a resolution. This is required by the national project that says we will support this effort. And then because it's a brand new thing, there is no wheel invented, they pick six counties nationally to be a test. Franklin County was one of the six because Tom Stickrath, who now heads Department of Public Safety, was the president of the Justice Center that Council for State Governments that kind of started this project. Mm-hmm. And so Franklin County was one of the six. I got very involved with them. They finished the project. They had a big presentation to the county commissioners. They are doing marvelous things. In fact, I would encourage you to have Michael Daniels on your show and talk about all the wonderful things Franklin County is doing to reverse this trend. So then they picked three states, phase two. Texas, California, and Ohio. Texas and California had their own paid staff. Ohio had no funding. They had no funding left. They just picked us, but no funding. So an organization, a foundation out of Akron called the PEGS Foundation, they had had a son who had schizophrenia, and they had put a foundation together to support this effort. They stepped up and funded it. And so we do two things. All the counties that have signed up, and right now there's about 48, we go make a visit to the county. I go personally. Tom Craig, who is the mental health director for the foundation, goes personally. I have a whole team now that goes with me. And we talk about all the things they can be doing, much of which are free and much of which they don't even know about. And then I put together a steering committee at the state level, which we're up to about 38 agencies state. We have all the key agencies. We have strength in numbers where we meet and talk about state policies and state changes. So it's a horizontal and a vertical, as mm-hmm. I call it.
Give me an example of something that they can do for free that they don't know that they can do.
Okay. We call it I nicknamed it the data dump. Every night when they get their list of arrests, they can send that list to their ADDA board, their mental health board. And they can say, okay, we have Joe in our jail. has he been a client of yours? They check with their providers. Oh, well, we lost track of Joe 3 months ago. Well, Joe's been arrested. Get down there right now. Tell the jail what his diagnosis is. Help with the medications. Simple. And a lot of these, they look at me and go, oh, we could do that. Just never thought of it. Now, all of a sudden, you've got the people that they've been taking care of them who may have lost track of them down there helping to, you know, re-help them
and
again.
And that also involves, though, training somebody to recognize this person might have an issue. Because as you said, it's not like Joe's going to say, hey, I need my meds.
We try to encourage all of them to do a mental health screen. It's a very brief screen, mm-hmm. basic questions they answer. If any of them are a yes, then that triggers to the next level of screening or gets them to the medical director of the jail to then do a more in-depth assessment. Yes.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the intersection of mental illness, mental health, and the criminal justice system. My guest right now, Evelyn Lundberg Stratton. She's a former Ohio Supreme Court Justice and Project Director for the Ohio Stepping Up Initiative. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And David in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi, I'm so glad to hear this. This is such a fundamental problem with our justice system. Justice Stratton, what can the average person do to get involved with this and to advance it?
Well, are you from Delaware?
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Delaware is one of our star counties. They are very active in the Stepping Up movement. And so I would contact your sheriff's office. Cassandra Neff is the one in charge of the project. But just contact your sheriff's office and say you want to get involved in this effort. There are many places they can put you as a volunteer with the housing. They can put you with, if you have any veterans background, they have a veterans court. You can be a peer mentor. There's multiple points of entry where you can get involved. But Stepping Up is very big in Delaware County. So I would encourage you to contact the sheriff's office and say, I heard about this. I want to get involved. Get me to the right person.
David, thanks a lot for that call. You know, we talked about how this trend of ending, you know, the change in how we address mental illness in this country. We were institutionalizing them up until the 50s or 60s. That changed. You said the funding never came through from the Kennedy administration after President Kennedy was assassinated, and that counties, when they closed mental health facilities, the money wasn't reallocated to the counties properly to address it at the county level. What has the role of the tough-on-crime policies been in all of this? Because that kind of percolated up in the 70s and 80s with the drug issue and the war on drugs.
It's almost a separate issue. I mean, tough on crime certainly has dramatically increased our prison population. And there's a tendency, I call it more time for the favorite crime. Every legislator has something they want to increase the crime.
Everyone's running for sheriff. That's the way I put it.
Well, no, a lot of these legislators have no criminal law background.
I
but
know.
there were like 93 bills introduced in the last 2 years that upped the crime, the penalty for something. But the issue of mental illness is really a type of a different issue. They don't have the treatment in the community, so they go to jail.
What about the issue of prison or jail triggering mental illness? The overcrowding.
I don't really see that. Okay. What you see is that they're on the streets. They've never gotten treatment. They've never been diagnosed. They commit a lot of petty crimes. Mostly they're petty. Yeah. A lot of them are petty. Then they get picked up. Then they go to jail, where they do get worse because now they really are in very confined, horrible. You know, they're often isolation.
It's a penalty. You know, it's a punishment. Yeah.
And so then there's also what we call drug induced psychosis. Sometimes that happens as well. So that's why the jails who want to do something to make a difference, they don't have the tools or resources, and that's what Stepping Up is trying to give them. But we're trying to get at reversing that trend. And when you talked in the next third about CIT, that's one of the solutions to reversing the trend of putting them in jail.
Ohio leads the nation with 43 mental health courts. What do mental health courts, what role do they play in all of this?
They're actually, they really only address a fairly small part of that issue. they're set up to address sort of the worst conditions, the ones that are the hardest to deal with. If you have a low level, if you can get just back on your medication, you'll be fine. You know, that doesn't really merit a mental health court. But a mental health court, the judge becomes a community leader. They bring in housing. They bring in the treatment people. They bring in the drug treatment people. They get everybody at the table and say, okay, well, how do we deal best with this person? Instead of sending them to 12 different locations and they'll never make one because they don't have a car and they don't have a calendar and they just can't navigate, we bring the team together and figure out how best can we take care of this person. It's just not a mental health court. We have almost 280 specialized dockets, drug courts, mental health courts, veterans courts, courts that deal with youth, courts that deal with prostitution, victims of prostitution, mm-hmm. human trafficking. Ohio clearly leads the nation in that regard.
Does it play? I mean, do we see results from all of that?
Oh, yes. All you need to do is go to a mental health court or a vet court or even a human trafficking court graduation, and it will just amaze you, the transformation in the person. They're back with their families. They're often in school. They're able to get on meds, get into work. The transformation has been amazing. Plus, there's a lot of studies now that show that it's very efficient.
Christian in Columbus, you're on the air with Evelyn Lundberg Stratton, former Ohio Supreme Court Justice. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I was just wondering what happens to the individuals once they are or once they leave from the criminal justice system. Do they go into extended long-term care for mental health treatment in a facility, or do they just kind of go out on the street and they're expected to go into outpatient treatment, you know, with like appointments with psychiatrists?
Yeah. Is this a wraparound type of thing that we're looking at, or are they just cut loose then?
Most of them, before we started this project, were just cut loose. They walked out the door, and that was the end of it. A lot of the hospitalizations, they can only keep them 2-3 days. They open the door, that's the end of it. So one of the things that we have really focused on is trying to connect them with services while they're in jail, and then making sure that there are abilities to follow with treatment afterwards. A lot of them are Medicaid eligible but never applied, or they're on Medicaid but they've disappeared from the system, get them connected with those services. And now we're
They're in jail.
While they're in jail, or sometimes the stay is so short, you have to really do it after they get out. But connecting them with services afterwards is a huge part of making this work. And the other huge part is then getting them housing. So many of these people are homeless, and you can do all the treatment you want, but if they're still homeless, you've really made little progress. So we're really focusing on trying to keep them out. You're trying to keep them from getting arrested in the first place, and then once they get out, trying to make sure they're linked to services.
You know, this House Bill 136 deals with capital crimes, people who have committed aggravated murder. And I'm thinking about all the other people who are in the prisons who have committed serious crimes. They're seriously mentally ill. They get out of prison eventually, often, most do eventually, and they're saddled with the mental illness. Often it's gone, still untreated or is exacerbated, and a felony.
Well, we have a very strong program with our prisons. It was started well before the jail project was started. And one of the things we did, I co-chaired for 8 years with now Governor Mike DeWine, the Attorney General Task Force on Mental Illness. And he gave us $500,000 to incentivize programs. And one of the things we tried to do is create housing for people that come out of jails and prisons. And so the prison focuses on reentry and trying to make sure they have those supports to keep them from recidivating, coming back into the system. Mm-hmm. But the same thing that we have to do when they come out of prison, the same thing we have to do when they come out of jail, but sometimes the crime is more serious. And then we're also trying to focus on employment, because as you know, if you have a felony, it's going to be really hard to get convicted.
Mm-hmm.
And
I
just met with a new group called Center for Employment. CEO, Center for Employment, I forget what the piece did. CEO, that's right, Opportunities, who specifically work on people who have serious convictions like felonies, trying to get them into the employment. And it's a very impressive program.
People who are very seriously mentally ill, is there a place for them anymore? That they can't work, they can't function, they cannot navigate, as you put it. They need to be in a hospital. Is there ever going to be a place like that again?
That is a huge issue is really a resource issue. There's a recognition that they need that, but we don't have the funding. This new budget, I will have to credit Governor DeWine and the House, and hopefully the Senate will hold firm, has more money in it for mental health treatment and youth and adult than any budget. Most budgets cut mental health, and especially with the opiates, the opiate crisis has sucked up all the money and they've taken it out of the mental health budget. For once, we now are getting some resources to look at all these different things that will keep that recycling from happening and get them treatment. So it's a big problem, but we're working on it very heavily.
That's former Ohio Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Lundberg Stratton. She's project director for the Ohio Stepping Up Initiative. She's also been working for about 5 years on a measure that is working its way through the Ohio General Assembly that would ban the death penalty in capital crime cases in which the convicted is seriously mentally ill and falls into one of four categories of serious mental illness. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to hear about crisis intervention teams. That's where officers learn how to de-escalate situations and get a person to treatment instead of jail. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A proposed Ohio House bill would bar the death penalty in cases where the convicted suffers from serious mental illness. The proposal comes from a growing understanding about the role of mental illness in serious crime. In this hour, we're talking about the intersection of mental health and criminal justice. Still with us is former Ohio Supreme Court Justice and current project director for the Ohio Stepping Up Initiative, which aims to reduce the number of people with mental illness in our jails, Evelyn Lundberg Stratton. Law enforcement officers often interact with mentally ill people in crisis. In fact, they're often the first people in the system to do so. Programs such as Crisis Intervention Team, or CIT, helps officers learn how to de-escalate the situations and get people to treatment instead of jail. Michael Woody is the former president of CIT International, and he's the current CIT Ohio coordinator. He joins us by phone. Welcome back.
Hey, you're welcome.
You know, part of me wonders why CIT isn't just a regular part of training for any police officer.
Well, I can tell you that here in Ohio, I retired from the Akron Police Department after 25 years, but those last 2 years I was the director of training. And so I realized back then that, well, wow, we deal with people with a mental illness on a lot of our calls. And yet our training that was required by the state of Ohio was only like maybe 30 minutes to an hour, and that just didn't cut it for 10% of the calls that a police officer normally goes on. It involves mental illness. So we were able through the years, since we've developed CIT, to take that just maybe a few hours, and for these cadets in an academy, they get a 20-hour course now here in Ohio on dealing with folks with mental illness and an education on mental illness, and to get them to realize that the person's not a criminal, you know, that they've got this illness.
I read that 12,000 officers in Ohio have been trained for crisis CIT.
That is correct. It's taken a while because the very first CIT class I put on the Akron Police Department, and that was in May of 2000, 40-hour course, mostly taught by your mental health professionals. And then we bring in people that have a mental illness that when they're having a good day, because officers don't normally see those kind of folks when they are having a good day. And it really sets the tone. Now, I did realize with my first class, you know, Akron back then was a department of about 500 officers, and I knew that these special officers, CIT officers, of course, they had to come from the patrol division because they're the ones that would get that call. Mm-hmm. But I wanted, what I searched for was officers that were emotionally mature and had a little bit of experience. And I handpicked them for that very first class. And, of course, they went out and did a wonderful job.
You know, and then I'm thinking, well, it seems to me the emotionally immature should be in the classes because they're less likely to respond appropriately. What, am I missing something?
No, and that's why now when they're in the academy, they get this 20-hour course on how to de-escalate this and sort of an introduction to CIT.
How is the training developed? I mean, what is it that they're learning?
Well, they're basically learning, first of all, not to fear people with a mental illness, but still to be vigilant. As a matter of fact, at the beginning of a CIT course, I always put up on the board, it is the wise officer who can, at times, conceal their combat-ready status. So what we teach them in the class is basically to show empathy for those with a mental illness, but you still have to be ready for anything to happen because you don't want the officers to get hurt or anything.
Do officers teach officers, or do you bring in experts, or is it a combination?
It is basically a combination. Now, in that first class, it was mostly the mental health system because there weren't any CIT officers with experience. But now, yeah, now it's a combination.
So you mentioned that at the time, Akron had 500 officers in its department at the time, and there's 12,000 across the state that are trained in it. That sounds like a lot, and I know Ohio leads the nation, but it's really a drop in the bucket, is it?
Well, there's 35,000 officers in the state of Ohio. So you're getting to, you know, at least a fourth of the officers. And let's face it, being a larger department, yes, we could have special officers for special people. But most law enforcement agencies are very small. And so if you don't get all your officers through the 40-hour course, then you might not have one available when the time comes. So you have to, you know, take that into consideration.
Justice Lumberg, what is your sense about how these kinds of efforts affect the situation?
Well, when I first started talking about mental health courts, we had two in Ohio. There were six in the country. And I heard about this thing called CIT, and I contacted Dr. Munitz and Lieutenant Woody and said, this seems to be something that should complement a mental health court if we can work together. So we formed a partnership, and one of the things that happens when you campaign, you're a very boring candidate as a justice because you can't talk about anything. So I made it my point every speech I gave to talk about mental health courts and CIT, and then Lieutenant Woody and I, with funding from NAMI, would go to a county, have a luncheon, try to get the sheriffs and the commissioners and judges to attend, and try to encourage them to start mental health courts and CIT. So we did this for many years, actually, till we reached sort of a saturation point where enough were encouraging others to do it, and it sort of caught fire, and so we didn't have to do that anymore. But we've been partners for a long time pushing this together.
Michael Woody, can you give me an example of an intervention moment? I mean, probably the only thing I've ever seen is Silver Linings Playbook, you know, which was a great movie and portrayed an intervention, but what happens? I mean, if somebody breaks a law, doesn't an officer have to direct, you know, put them in jail, or what are their options?
Well, sometimes we have different options. It depends on what the victim may want, if there is one. But, you know, the big thing with the officer going to most of these calls is usually somebody calls, there's a person out there in the public and they're acting strange, and the officer gets there, and this person does have a mental illness, but you don't know that right off the bat. It could be drugs or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the big thing is to calm the person down. You know, you still have to be ready for anything, but to start asking the person, hey, you know, what's going on today? Tell me more, getting a story from them and getting them to calm down.
And then what do people what is the process? So you, then what do you do from there? If they don't get referred for committing a crime, do you just walk away, or how does that work?
No. We normally get them the help that they need. We take them to a mental health facility or an emergency room. Okay. And going back to that, early on in 1977, when I became a policeman, when we picked up somebody that had a mental illness that wasn't a danger too much to themselves or others, we could take them to a place just outside the city limits called Fallsview, set up for people that have a mental illness. And when we would go into Fallsview, the staff were actually glad to see us. They would take the person that we had, take them in a back room, and we wouldn't see them anymore. Then we were back out there on the streets doing our patrol. But then Fallsview closed down. Hmm. So now where do we go? Well, we had three hospitals in the city of Akron. So we would basically, as it turned out, go begging to the three emergency rooms, will you please take this person? And they really weren't set up in these emergency departments to handle people with a mental illness. Mm-hmm. Yes, there may be a disturbance and this and that. So we're pretty good at reading body language. The emergency rooms didn't seem to want them. So what did we do? Well, our only choice was to put a small charge on them for whatever it was and take them to the jail, who couldn't refuse them as long as we had that charge on them. Mm-hmm. Boy, you're not going to get better in sitting in a jail cell.
Yeah, Justice Stratton?
So we are almost a victim of our own success. We have 12,000 officers now. But one of the worst things to do is, for an officer from their position, is to say, oh, we don't have any place to take them. We have to take them to emergency room. You don't have time to sit there 3, 4, 5 hours, sometimes days, because they don't have any place to put them. You have to get back on the street. So one of the projects of stepping up is to try to push what we call crisis centers. It's a drop-off. One of our models is in Arizona. Franklin County is trying to do that model, where the officer can take them to the crisis center. They spend 8 to 10 minutes filling out paperwork, dropping the person off. The crisis center then triages. Do they need to go into a hospital because they're so seriously ill? Can they go back to outpatient? Can we release them to family? Can we just get them connected again with their provider? Or do we need to call the office and say, we really need to take them and put them back and take them down to jail? Huge difference in that, giving the officer the freedom to get back on the street. So there has been $30 million added to the budget right now to help. We had money added in the last cycle. Now we have some more money to increase these crisis centers. And we're asking for some money to have 4 test models in Ohio to start developing that process. Because if you have all these officers trained and all the option is to emergency room or jail, you really haven't made a lot of progress. So we're really focusing on what we call crisis centers.
Sam in Columbus, you're on the air. We're just about out of time, but I wanted to get to you. Hi, Sam.
Good morning. Thank you, Ann.
Yep.
Yeah, my question is regarding the revolving door between the prison system, the community, and the homeless situation. It seems to me like the real answer here is strengthening community mental health, especially for people that are duly diagnosed or people that are uninsured or underinsured. There don't seem to be enough providers to go around, and I'm wondering what is being done to address that situation.
Justice Stratton.
Okay, so we have a huge workforce development problem. There's a lot of new money in the budget to address treatment. There's a lot of efforts with stepping up to find housing and treatments. But I was at a meeting yesterday with most of the mental health directors from around Ohio, and everybody can't find people to hire. They can't find enough psychiatrists. They can't find enough workers. They can't find enough treatment providers. So we have to really work on workforce development, and that's a big focus to try to encourage colleges to add more courses, to train not just psychiatrists, but all the way down to the healthcare worker. So we, again, a victim of our own success, the more money we put into it, the more we have to hire people, but they just aren't out there. So it's something we're really working hard on.
Michael Woody, before we're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you what you think is as far as CIT in Franklin County in Columbus. Is there enough? Should there be more? And how does this community get more CIT training?
Well, just to let you know, out of our 88 counties, every single county in Ohio has CIT officers, and Franklin County was an early adopter. And of course, they have a CIT coordinator on the Columbus Police Department, but they've been doing very well. Of course, you can always use more, and that's probably the goal.
All right. Well, Michael Woody, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Hey, you're welcome.
Michael Woody started the first crisis intervention team program in Ohio. He is the CIT program coordinator for the state. He's also a law enforcement liaison for the Criminal Justice Coordinating Center of Excellence. Also, Evelyn Lundberg-Stratton, former Ohio Supreme Court Justice and Project Director for the Ohio Stepping Up Initiative. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Justice Stratton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm very happy to spread the word.
And thanks to our intern, Joe Motz, for producing this show. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.